Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with another Wall Street scandal erupting now, which follows a familiar pattern, this time with an opaque family hedge fund, Arcadius Capital, whose founder had a history of run-ins with regulators. He got to accumulate gigantic holdings in publicly trading companies through secret derivatives trading from Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and other investment banks. Then the founder, Bill Hwang, makes wild bets that fail to meet a margin call, prompting the insiders at Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley to dump $19 billion of stock blocks on Friday, causing market capitalization losses of over $33 billion, leaving other banks like Nomura and Credit Suisse to take billions in losses as their shares take a tumble. Joining us is Dennis Kelleher, the President and Chief Executive Officer of Better Markets, Inc., a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit that promotes the public interest in the U.S. and global financial markets, and, as a Wall Street watchdog, has been referred to as a persistent thorn in the side of Wall Street. He joins us to discuss how small family funds like Arcadius are exempt from SEC oversight and can, in exchange for fees, get excessive leverage to build positions that circumvent reporting requirements. Then we'll examine the World Health Organization report on the origins of COVID-19, which appears to have been shaped by China to dismiss the possibility of a lab accident in Wuhan in order to blame the pandemic on a zoonotic leap from animals to humans or from frozen food coming into China from abroad. Lawrence Gostin, University President and founding O'Neill Chair in Global Health Law at Georgetown University Law Center, who directs the World Health Organization's Collaborating Center on National and Global Health Law, joins us to discuss the report and warnings of impending doom from the new CDC director, who said that, quote, "Right now, I'm scared." Then finally, we will speak with Andrew Gordon, Deputy Director of Community Legal Services at the Legal Rights Center in Minneapolis-St. Paul. He joins us to discuss today's opening statements in the trial of the police officer recorded on a cell phone, taking the life of George Floyd, in a trial which will not deal with the history of systemic racism and police brutality, nor will the jury hear statistics of disproportionate force being used by police against blacks and indigenous subjects. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Dennis Kelleher, who's the President and Chief Executive Officer of Better Markets, Inc., a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization that promotes the public interest in the U.S. and global financial markets. Better Markets is a Wall Street watchdog and has been referred to as a persistent thorn in the side of Wall Street. And Dennis has held several senior staff positions in the United States Senate, most recently as Chief Counsel and Senior Leadership Advisor to the Chairman of the Senate Democratic Policy Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dennis Kelleher.
Thanks, Ian. Nice to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And I got your report on this latest Wall Street scandal, and we don't know how bad it is. This is Arcadius Capital. How do you pronounce that, by the way?
Arcadius. Everybody's pronouncing it multiple ways. Nobody knows what this hedge fund was doing, and they don't even know how to pronounce its name.
Okay. Well, I don't feel so bad then. So this is what I understand. Arcadius Capital got to accumulate gigantic holdings in publicly traded companies through secret derivatives trading from Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and other investment banks. Then its founder, Bill Hwang, makes wild bets that fail to meet margin calls, prompting the insiders at Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley to dump $19 billion of stock blocks on Friday, causing market capitalization losses of over $33 billion, leaving other banks like Nomura and Credit Suisse to take billions in losses as their shares take a tumble. So did I get it right?
Yes.
Well, we don't know how bad it is yet.
Well, we don't know how bad it is, and we probably won't know for a long time. And, of course, that raises one of the big questions, which is why don't we know? Why today in 2021, after the blow-up of the hedge fund long-term capital management in 1998 caused a systemic event, and then we have another financial crash in 2007, 2008, and 2009, where nobody knows what's going on because there's all these non-transparent, undisclosed financial shenanigans going on. And here we are yet again with Wall Street's biggest taxpayer-backed banks and a bunch of hedge funds, or at least one hedge fund and probably more, getting into trouble once again by engaging in undisclosed secret derivatives dealing based on massive leverage, which is just a fancy way of saying hedge funds borrowed billions and billions of dollars from these big banks so that they had, you know, this particular hedge fund was reported to have somewhere between 5 and 10 times leverage of what they had for assets. Well, when they get the leverage, they've got to borrow it from somebody. So they borrow it from the big banks, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Nomura, Credit Suisse, and others. And yet, this all comes as a big shock because it's all done through regulatory loopholes and secret dealings in the background. The market doesn't know what's going on. Nobody else knows what's going on. Well, how come these banks are still engaged in such dangerous, high-risk activities and people don't know? And it's because the regulators, being pushed by Wall Street's allies in Congress, aren't doing their job. And they haven't been doing it for a long time still.
So, but what seems to be happening here is that these small family funds, like Archegos or Archegos or whatever it's called, they're exempt from SEC oversight. And what they do is they pay fees to Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, and they don't necessarily tell each of these investment banks how much they're leveraged and what they're doing necessarily. But in exchange for fees, they get this excessive leverage to build positions that circumvent reporting requirements. Is that how it works?
Well, yes. In fact, what they do is they do indirectly what they're not allowed to do directly, or if they did it directly, they'd have to disclose it. And they do it indirectly through derivatives and structured products. In this case, it looks like the use of credit default swaps, total return swaps, and so-called contracts for difference. But it doesn't really matter what it's called. The problem is that these the biggest firms on Wall Street that are not only backed by taxpayers, but of course only exist today because they were bailed out by taxpayers, these banks are just hungry for profits any way possible. And so when you do that, risk management will never, ever win out over profit and bonus maximization. And you have these hedge funds, like the one we're talking about here, who engage in massive amounts of trading, which generates big fees for the banks. And of course, when they want to lever up their positions, put on a lot of leverage, they borrow that money from the very same banks. They're called the prime brokerage division of the big banks. And so the banks are making big money by lending these hedge funds money, and they make money on the fees from trading and other activities. So these hedge funds provide just this massive amount of income, most of which is cost-free. And therefore, what that means is the money they make off the hedge funds drops almost entirely into the bonus pool. And so what you have is you have these gigantic banks creating and pitching these complex derivatives because they're lucrative for those banks. And so we end up in the position where you have hedge funds like this one that want to engage in extremely high-risk activities with a lot of borrowed money. And the banks and the hedge funds, by the way, are incredibly interconnected, which is another systemic risk. They're interconnected, they're largely unregulated, and they're largely non-transparent. And so which is basically the definition for what we call the shadow banking system. which was at the core of causing and spreading the 2008 crash, which was supposed to be regulated by the regulators so these types of blowups couldn't happen. But this shadow banking system is all taking place where the banks and the bankers are getting rich over the fees and the bonuses, and nobody really knows what's going on, and very few people are paying attention to risk management. And that has been exacerbated over the last 4 years under Trump, but it's still going to take a while for the regulators to start paying attention to both what the financial shenanigans are, how dangerous they are, and where the risks are.
And again, I'm speaking with Dennis Kelleher, who's the president and chief executive officer of Better Markets, Inc., a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization that promotes the public interest in the U.S. and global financial markets. Better Markets is a Wall Street watchdog and has been referred to as a persistent thorn in the side of Wall Street. So on the regulatory front, you mentioned that Trump's whole MO was to put Dracula in charge of the blood bank. Dreadful people.
Exactly. Well,
he put in charge of his cabinet. Their job was to destroy the very department that they were supposed to run. And I'm sure the same happened with the SEC. What's happening now? You've got to build up staffing, don't you? I mean, didn't they cut a whole bunch of regulators from the SEC?
Well, Ian, you put your finger on it. The Trump administration deregulated Wall Street once again in one of the most irresponsible ways possible, and indeed put the president of Goldman Sachs in charge of the National Economic Council, literally put Goldman Sachs in the White House to run the national economic policy for the country. Well, of course, what did you get? You got a lot of deregulation and a lot of regulators who were non-regulators. And so they gutted what was called the Financial Stability Oversight Council, which, by the way, is supposed to regulate the shadow banking system like these hedge funds, which is supposed to be paying attention to systemic risks like we are seeing emerging here. They also gutted the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is not only supposed to protect consumers on a one-by-one basis, but also protect systemic risks from building up, like subprime mortgages, which blew up in 07 and 08. And they did put deregulators in the SEC, the CFTC, and elsewhere. And indeed, the person who actually ran this particular hedge fund was banned from the industry because he settled criminal and civil charges in 2012 for $60 million fine, a ban on being in the industry for some number of years and limiting his activities afterwards. And in 2012 for insider trading back in 2008-2009. So this guy shouldn't have been in the business at all and was largely prohibited from being in the business until, guess what? Last year, the SEC, for some inexplicable reason, rolled back the limitations that they had put on him and actually enabled him to be in the position where he could engage in this high-risk activity. So what we now have to do, having watched 4 years of the decimation of many of the financial protections that were put in place after the financial crash of 08 due to the Dodd-Frank financial reform law, we now have to get regulators back at work. And the Biden administration has nominated a number of people. Gary Gensler, who was a terrific regulator at the CFTC from 2008 to about 2013 or 14, he was there. He's been nominated to chair the SEC now, which is the primary market regulator. The SEC is supposed to be the cop on the Wall Street beat, but of course, the cop was put in the back room for the last 4 years. But Gary Gensler's nomination is pending in the United States Senate, and so right now there's only an acting chair of the SEC, an acting chair of the CFTC. And most of the other seats don't have anybody in them yet. So we're at a pretty dangerous time right now where, you know, you look at what happened in January with the GameStop stock frenzy. You look at what's happening now with hedge funds, and you would think that the elected officials in Congress would prioritize getting these financial cops confirmed in their job and put cracking the whip on the high-risk cowboys on Wall Street who are relentlessly endangering not just our financial system, but our entire economy for the sake of their bonuses.
Well, that's why they call the revolving door between Wall Street and the White House government sacks, right? Were you talking about Gary Cohn earlier?
Gary Cohn, right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, he distinguished himself in the most shameful way. He was so upset by the Nazis marching with their tiki torches, saying that the Jews will not replace us, and that horrible stuff that happened in Charlottesville, Virginia, which, by the way, according to Biden, prompted him to run for president. What motivated him. But then Gary Cohn makes all kinds of noises about how terrible it was that Trump talked about good people on both sides. But he stayed in the White House. Guess why? To get the tax cut for the 1% of the 1% through. And once they got the tax cut for the billionaires, he goes back to Wall Street.
Well, it's the tax cuts and deregulation. I was going to say, you know, the CEO of Citigroup, Chuck Prince, said in 2007 that as long as the music is playing, the banks are going to get up and dance. And what he means is that whenever anyone will pay for high-risk, dangerous activities, the banks are going to do that business to juice their bonuses unless they're forced to stop or something blows up. And that's the problem. These banks will never, and these bankers, let's not let the individuals off, these executives, these supervisors, they simply will not regulate themselves because there's just too much money at stake. We saw it at Goldman Sachs with Abacus during the crash and its Big Short, where it enriched itself at the expense of everybody else. We saw it at Goldman Sachs and the 1MDB shenanigans, where they basically facilitated the corruption of the entire country of Malaysia while pocketing $600 billion in about $600 million in about 10 months. And we're seeing it again, where the risk controls and self-regulation will never, ever work. The only thing that's ever going to protect the financial system, the economy, and the American people are aggressive regulators and prosecutors, and they have to be on the job. And the problem is that Wall Street and the financial industry has bought too many allies in Washington to do their bidding, who have tried to put limitations on the regulators and prevent the prosecutors from doing their job. What we need is the Biden administration to start prioritizing this. Now, they got a lot on their plate. They've got to deal with COVID. They got to deal with an economic crash. But Wall Street's wilding, again, will cause a crash if we don't get these regulators and prosecutors in place, back on the job, and getting these bankers back in line.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, the situation that we're talking about, though, with Arcadius Capital and this character that you just explained to us, that, my God, he'd already been banned by regulators, and some mysterious way he got reinstated in an opaque way. And then no sooner did this guy get reinstated, he took the banks down for $33 billion. But the really unpleasant part of it is that the people who enabled him, like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, they got out, they dumped their stuff on Friday. Isn't that what happened?
What's going to be very interesting here, Ian, is the investigations, which are going to have to determine not only how these highly leveraged secret bets were placed and the derivatives that were used, but over the last 6, 7, 10 weeks, many of the stocks that were the collateral for the borrowed money actually went up from, say, $40 to $100 a share. So they went up pretty markedly in a short period of time for no apparent reason. And then remarkably, in the early days of last week, they started dropping precipitously. Now, part of that was due to some activities at these companies, but part of it is inexplicable. So there's no clear fundamental reason, at least right now, that's publicly known for the stock volatility and what resulted in it precipitated these margin calls, which resulted in the banks, with apparently, reportedly, Goldman Sachs leading the way, selling about $19 billion of blocks of stock that were collateral last Friday, which precipitated market capitalization losses of about $33 billion in a bunch of these stocks. And so the questions, of course, are not only about the unregulated shadow banking system and what did the Goldman Sachs's of the world, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Nomura, Credit Suisse, and others, not only what were they doing in facilitating all of this, but who was trading in these stocks that caused the stocks to have a run-up and then to have a precipitous drop, which is to say, what really caused these stock movements? And the reason that's so important is because the very same biggest banks who are the prime brokers for the hedge funds that the taxpayers back, the very same banks are also the banks that are big dealers and market makers in these stocks. So they're on all, not only are they all interconnected, they're all on all sides of the deal and the deal flows. And so it, unpacking that is going to be job one of the SEC to determine whether or not and who broke the laws here, because part of this is due to unregulated shadow banking, and they have to be regulated again, as I said. But there's a fair amount of smoke here, not fire yet, based on what's publicly known, but a fair amount of smoke here that not only are they unregulated, but there may have been some laws and rules broken here, and it's time for the regulators and the cops to get back on the street and find out what happened here and get these banks back in line so that they don't threaten the jobs, homes, and livelihoods of the American people again, like they did just a little over 10 years ago.
And of course, the American people, Main Street bailed out Wall Street, and they're back at it. It's absolutely appalling. And I thank you for joining us here today, Dennis Kelleher.
Thanks very much, Ian. And anybody who wants some more information should go to our website at www.bettermarkets.com, because we're going to stay on this issue and we're going to hound the regulators and the prosecutors until the job gets done.
Again, www.bettermarkets.com.
Right. Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot. And again, I've been speaking with Dennis Keller, who's the President and Chief Executive Officer of Better Markets, Inc., a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization that promotes the public interest in the U.S. and global financial markets. And Better Markets is a Wall Street watchdog that has been referred to as a persistent thorn in the side of Wall Street. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the World Health Organization report on the origins of COVID-19.
Get from out the road when he get dough, it's horrible. Time is money, spend, wait, save, invest, affest. The 10K, so cave, a chicken chest, S. Yes, y'all are dumb and get your trickles. The best ball is pitching and rub to get a nickels. But tut, tut, he about to change the price again. It go up each time, he blow up like hydrogen. Villain here, albums shrilling in fear. It won't stop, top bill until he a gazillionaire. Villain, his agenda is clear. Ending this year with dividends to spear here. A new meaning to sales through the roof.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lawrence Gostin, who's a university professor and founding O'Neill Chair in Global Health Law at Georgetown University's Law Center, where he directs the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law and the World Health Organization's Collaborating Center on National and Global Health Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Gostin.
It's great to be back with you. Thank you, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, and I want to talk to you about the report that's coming out soon from the World Health Organization, which already Secretary of State Blinken has suggested that the Chinese have had undue influence over this report. There's a draft that's been leaked to the Associated Press that indicates that the report will certainly not suggest that there was an accident at the Wuhan lab, but rather that it was a zoonotic leap. And the draft obtained by the Associated Press lists four scenarios in order of likelihood for the emergence of COVID-19. Topping the list was transmission from bats through other animals, which they said was likely to be very likely. They evaluated direct spread from bats to humans as likely and said that spread to humans from the packaging of cold chain food products was possible but not likely. How does that sound to you, Lawrence?
Well, the conclusions sound to me about right. Unfortunately, we haven't really learned anything because most of us in the scientific community said right at the beginning, you know, up to nearly a year ago, that was the most likely outcome. Because if you look at the way that viruses spread and emerge, something like 75% of all novel outbreaks start with an animal reservoir, and then they have a leap to a human. And so we haven't learned very much, but I think that the outcome sounds right and most probable to me.
Well, obviously the Chinese are very sensitive about this, because originally, shortly after the outbreak, there was an effort by Australia and other countries to get an international investigation going into the origins that was independent. And the Chinese not only shut that down, they really went to town on the government of Australia and slapped tariffs on wine and Australian agricultural products. So they, what's going on with the China and the WHO? It's worth noting, of course, that the Trump administration pulled the United States out of the WHO. So we're not in a position to really have much influence if we're not even in the organization. But Secretary of State Blinken seems to be saying that he's suspicious of this report because it is subject to undue Chinese influence.
Yeah, well, first of all, as we know, President Biden on day one reversed President Trump's decision. So we are a member of WHO. We never did leave. But I do credit Secretary Blinken's statement. I think that this was a report that lacked transparency and accountability. I think it's highly likely that the Chinese government interfered with the report and certainly did not allow the independent scientists access to all of the independent information that it needed in an unfettered way. And so the conclusion sounds about right to me, but in the conclusion, they gave some credit to the Chinese narrative that this came from overseas through frozen food. And I don't think CDC or WHO or other independent experts really believe that that is a credible scenario.
Well, what about suggestions from the outgoing head of the CDC, Redfield, and Dr. Birx as well, that they believe that it was an accident in the Wuhan Institute for Virology, the lab? Now, there were reports from U.S. diplomats in China back in 2017 who visited the lab in Wuhan, and apparently the so-called bat lady, who does all of the research or is a leading researcher into the transmission of viruses from bats, she told these American diplomats that she was concerned that the staff at this new Level 4 lab were not fully trained. Now these diplomats, according to the Washington Post writer Josh Rogan, who's got a new book out now about the origins of, about the U.S.-China relations and the deterioration of them recently, and it covers this area as well. He said that these diplomats are quite sorry that they didn't make more of a stink back then. So what are we to make of these comments from Redfield and Birx and others?
You know, the truth is we'll never know. And that's very sad that we're never going to really understand the full origins of the pandemic, because not knowing is going to impede us in fighting COVID-19 going forward, but also impede us in preventing the next pandemic. So it's a global tragedy, make no mistake about it. And I've never thought that the leak from the Wuhan Institute was a likely scenario. Most of these events, as I've said, are naturally occurring. But I don't think that the speculation will go away because the WHO experts didn't have full and independent access to the lab and all of its records and all of its audits and speak to all of its staff. And so, you know, there'll always be a question mark over it. And that is a shame, because WHO could have ended that theory, but there still will be speculation. As I say, Ian, to me, it wouldn't be my highest probability event, because these things rarely happen. And when they do, it's very hard to hide them. But of course, if anybody could hide it, it would be China.
And again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Gostin, who's a university professor and founding O'Neill Chair in Global Health Law at Georgetown University's Law Center, where he directs the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law and the World Health Organization's Collaborating Center on National and Global Health. Let's turn to another breaking story about not just about this WHO report into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic, but comments that have been made by the new CDC director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, who made some very, very heartfelt but quite alarming comments, saying that on Monday she said she had a feeling of impending doom, saying that right now I'm scared. And this, of course, is about the extent to which the pandemic is flourishing in this country with new strains. So what exactly do you take from Dr. Walensky's warnings?
Well, you know, at the start, you know, I like Dr. Walensky a lot. She's a breath of fresh air. You know, just a really caring, compassionate, intelligent woman. I think she may be overreacting a bit. We are in a perilous position right now because of a combination of pandemic fatigue, governors removing mask mandates and opening up businesses and indoor dining, and just the sheer number of variants that we're facing that are more transmissible. So I think, you know, there are a lot of reasons to worry over the next, say, 4 to 6 weeks. But I think after that, we're going to see the vaccine really take hold and start to break chains of transmission. And I think we have to give the American public some hope. And there is a lot of good news. I've seen this movie before, to the extent that when you have a vaccine that's that highly effective, you know, over 80% effective, and when you have widespread vaccination coverage and penetration, which we're likely to have by mid to late summer, you can see a dramatic drop in cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. And I do expect that we're going to be in a much better position by the spring and summer.
Well, Dr. Walensky said that we've come such a long way with these three authorized vaccines. But the point she was making, I think, is directed at these governors that are opening up states. She's sort of pleading here for the nation to keep following these mitigation measures. And to quote her, just please hold on a little while longer.
Right.
Is that what's at stake here? That, in other words, we're almost...
It is. You know, Ian, when I was a little boy, the book that seared in my mind that I read was All Quiet on the Western Front. After suffering enormous hardship during World War I, and actually that was also the great influenza pandemic going on then as well, the war was over, and then a stray bullet hit the main character and he died, which told me is that, you know, you can't stop before you get to the finish line. And we are. We're giving up now in our pandemic prevention measures. And that's a big mistake because we are going to be in a good place. But in the interim, you know, we could lose tens of thousands of lives, which were fully preventable if we'd only hold on a little bit longer. So Dr. Walensky's absolutely right in that regard.
Well, the numbers are staggering, are they not, of the numbers of infections? So it's 30 million, right?
Yeah, I mean, the numbers are staggering. But we're also already seeing the vaccine taking effect because we're not seeing the spiraling numbers of hospitalizations and deaths. Because we've got, you know, our nursing home residents and other vulnerable populations mostly vaccinated, we're not going to see the same, you know, horrible overflow of hospitals and people dying as bad as we did in previous months. So I think, we've got to hold on. You know, we've got, even if you're vaccinated, you still got to have common sense. And if you're not vaccinated, you're in a perilous position. So let's just all get vaccinated. Until we all are, let's wear masks, let's distance, let's be outdoors, and let's not do foolish things like indoor dining.
So could you say then that infections are sort of out of control, but deaths are under control?
I would say, certainly cases are high. I don't think they're out of control yet, but they're really high, and they're unnecessarily high. We know how to stop this without vaccines even. We're just not doing it. And then hospitalizations and deaths, we're still going to get them. We haven't controlled it completely. But, yeah, I mean, these vaccines are going to really help a lot of people who would otherwise have died. If you're elderly, if you've got a pre-existing condition and comorbidities, you were at real risk of death if you're vaccinated. It's got near 100% effectiveness against really fatal or dangerous outcomes.
So just in the last few minutes, Lawrence Garston, what did you make of, I don't know whether you saw the interview that Dr. Birx had with Sanjay Gupta on CNN, but she said that most of the COVID-19 deaths in this country were preventable. But at the same time, she didn't accept any complicity and responsibility for the fact that they were preventable. It's a kind of a mixed message, to say the least.
Yeah. I know Deborah Birx very well. She's very smart, very caring person. She never should have accepted this position under the Trump administration, but yet she did. She was the head of the task force, so she's responsible. She's accountable. And yes, we could have prevented a lot of deaths, but she was in charge at the time.
Well, we're talking about 550,000, right? That's a lot of...
We're talking about a catastrophic consequence for the United States, you know, more than all of the wars that we've been in. It's really... the U.S. has suffered so much. We have been among the worst, if not the worst, performer in the world. And we're the richest country in the world. We have a world-class CDC and health system, and yet we failed, and we failed because of really poor leadership. I think we've got good leadership now, but people need to listen and to adhere to the recommendations of the Biden administration and to Dr. Walensky.
But just in closing, Deborah Birx, or Dr. Birx, is, even you just said that she's responsible, but ultimately the responsibility was with Trump, right? She could not get Trump to do the right thing. Neither could Fauci.
But I think Tony spoke the truth publicly, and he was willing to go against the president. She was less willing to do so. So in my mind, the president is, you know, the buck stops with him. If I were Dr. Redfield or Dr. Birx or others, I would not have agreed to work for Donald Trump in the COVID response, because ultimately it was a losing effort and it was a discredited effort.
Right, but Trump would have just had more of these Dr. Scott Atlases, right? These quacks.
Yeah, he would have. Of course he would have. But I think, you know, one needs to draw the line. And not be complicit in these kinds of preventable deaths. I mean, everybody makes their own personal decision of conscience. I certainly would not have worked for the Trump administration.
Well, just in closing, though, do you think you could also blame Rupert Murdoch and these media outlets that spread disinformation, that turned wearing masks into a political issue, encouraging people not to socially distance and wear masks, etc.?
Oh, I mean, the falsehoods, the conspiracy theories, they were there then. They're still there now with false things and shockingly false things being said about vaccines and their dangers and their intent. And, of course, throughout, we remember the hydroxychloroquine issue. There's so many times when just the simple act of wearing a mask for your health and the health of your neighbor, that should never be a political event, but it became a political symbol and a culture war symbol. That's unforgivable.
Well, Lawrence Gustin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me, and take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Gustin, who's a university professor and founding O'Neill Chair in Global Health Law at Georgetown University Law Center, where he directs the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law and the World Health Organization's Collaborating Center on National and Global Health Law. We're going to take a brief station break and back speaking with the Deputy Director of Community Legal Services at the Legal Rights Center in Minneapolis-St. Paul on today's opening statements in the trial of the police officer recorded on a cell phone taking the life of George Floyd.
I don't need no doctor, 'cause I know what's in me. I don't need no doctor, no, no, 'cause I know what's in me. Yeah. Been too long away from a man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Andrew Gordon, the Deputy Director of Community Legal Services at the Legal Rights Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, whose work advocates for communities of color and immigrants. In 2016, he was awarded the Social Justice Award by the Minnesota chapter of the National Lawyers Guild for his work representing individuals charged with protest-related crimes following the murder of Jamal Khalkhal. And he was also part of the team awarded with the Law of the People Award for his work supporting community advocates following the murder of George Floyd. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Gordon.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And you watched the coverage today of the George Floyd's first day with opening remarks by lawyers and some witnesses. There were three witnesses. The first one, a 9/11 dispatcher. The second, a cashier who worked across the street from where George Floyd lost his life. And then Zonia Williams, the second, who was an eyewitness called by prosecutors, a martial arts instructor. So there were some technical difficulties, though, with the TV feed. So what were you able to learn from today's coverage?
There was nothing truly surprising coming up to today's coverage, right? We got opening statements, and we did get the bulk, I think, of at least, well, we got all of two witnesses, and almost, I would imagine, the bulk of the third. Well, I think what we learned today from the witnesses, particularly, is that there is a lot of video, and there are a lot of people who saw what happened, a lot of people who were there and can give a first-hand account. That's going to be interesting to see how that plays into this idea that we have all seen what happened to George Floyd, because we've all seen at least 8 minutes and 42 seconds worth of bystander video showing us kind of what happened. I think it's going to be interesting going forward watching the juxtaposition between what we've all seen already plus now potentially new evidence and whether that changes the narrative.
Well, the witness that I mentioned, Donald Williams II, the martial arts instructor and fighter, he was one of the eyewitnesses that's heard on the cell phone video that everybody's seen, and that was taken by a very brave young woman who stuck with it. He's heard berating the police about what they're doing to George Floyd, is he not?
Mm-hmm. He is. And I think one of the reasons why it was so important to not to certify him as an expert per se, but certainly to establish his background in martial arts, is that I think what they will end up explaining is that because of his experience in martial arts, he recognizes just how dangerous what's happening is. and he's emotional and he's combative and he's trying to confront and get the police to change what they're doing, because he recognizes, based on his rating, that they're hurting George Floyd, and not only are they hurting him, but they're endangering his life.
And he was talking about, what was it, the blood hold or something?
A blood chokehold, yeah.
Blood chokehold, right, right.
And it'll be interesting because his testimony, his direct testimony, is not yet finished. And so I think the prosecution locked out a little bit in how the proceedings ended today, where they effectively had a very compelling witness go last. The jury is going to go home with his testimony fresh in their mind. They're going to get a good night's sleep, hopefully, and come back tomorrow morning and be confronted with more of, hopefully, his compelling testimony. So it's interesting how the day ended, and it will be interesting to see how the day starts tomorrow. But the jurors are effectively getting the best first-day witness, both at the end of the first day and at the beginning of the second day.
Well, have the jury seen the video yet? Because, frankly, from my point of view, that tells the whole story.
They've seen some video. When you say this video, I'm assuming you mean the
9 minutes
video
video that was watching the last breaths in the life of George Floyd. We all saw that.
Yeah, my recollection, because I was dipping in and out of the coverage, is that it has not been shown. I'm open to being wrong about that, but based on what I saw, I did not see them display or go through that video today.
So tell me about...
Except an opening statement. It wasn't done in a witness testimony, I should say.
Right. Well, it's the 9 minutes that's the key.
Yeah.
And that if you even did 9 minutes of silence, it would make the point.
Yeah, it was interesting because there was, prior to the beginning of today's testimony, there was a press conference held by the family outside of the Hennepin County Government Center where they, in fact, did that. There were family members who were able to talk a little bit about George Floyd, talked a little bit about the settlement, and then immediately before 9 a.m. Minnesota time, they took a knee for 8 minutes and 42 seconds to signify the amount of time that Derek Chauvin had his knee on George Floyd's back and neck. And they did it in silence, and it was very solemn, and it was very powerful.
And again, I'm speaking with Andrew Gordon, the Deputy Director of Community Legal Services at the Legal Rights Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, whose work advocates for communities of color and immigrants. In 2016, he was awarded the Social Justice Award by the Minnesota chapter of the National Lawyers Guild for his work representing individuals charged with protest-related crimes following the murder of Jamar Clark. And he was also part of the team awarded with the Law of the People Award for his work supporting community advocates following the murder of George Floyd. You mentioned the $27 million settlement, Andrew. What impact do you expect that to have on the jury? The idea that a lot of money's already been paid out by the city. And yeah, there was some concern about jurors either learning about this or not. I'm not quite sure of how that plays. How do you think it plays?
I think there are two primary concerns. One that the state would have and the other that the defense would have. The defense concern, I think, is that jurors are going to learn about the settlement and they're going to learn about the amount of money that the case was settled for. And they're going to take that as an indication that Derek Chauvin is guilty. And they're going to find him guilty because the city has given an indication that they believe he was responsible for some kind of wrongdoing. That would be the defense concern. There is a related concern on the other side of the aisle, though, because I think from a prosecution perspective, the concern would be that you have individual jurors or maybe the jury group itself who would say to themselves, you know what, a wrong was committed here. George Floyd's family has been compensated for that wrong. We're not seeing ample evidence that Derek Chauvin is actually guilty of a crime, and it's okay to find him not guilty because the family has already been compensated. And so I think there are related concerns there, each of which play into the question of can a juror or jury be impartial and can they be unbiased and can they make a decision of guilt and innocence based solely on the evidence that's presented to them? And I think that's the question that you saw raised time and time again during jury selection by Judge Cahill, by Eric Nelson, Chauvin's attorney, by the prosecutors who were doing jury selection. That was a question that was raised the entire time. And it has to be a question that lingers or remains in the back of their mind because at this point, they don't know what the jurors are going to do when they actually get the evidence. And we're likely, what, 3.5 weeks away from that particular occasion. But it'll be interesting to see what those deliberations then look like and what the ultimate result is, and whether we will learn, I think, later on, whether the settlement played into what the ultimate result in the criminal case would be.
Well, what I find extraordinary, though, Andrew, about this trial is that it will not deal with the history of systemic racism and police brutality, nor will the jury hear statistics of disproportionate force being used by police against Black and Indigenous suspects. And that's the work that you do, is it not?
That is correct.
So is it true that you can't go into that area?
Yeah, so once you get into a criminal trial process, everyone involved in the process, defense attorneys, prosecutors, judges, clerks, whoever's involved, will tell you that you are talking about a specific individual and a specific allegation. And they will bend over backwards to tell you that systems are not on trial because the criminal legal system is not designed to hold systems accountable. It's designed to hold people accountable. And so the system, in the sense that it is the Minneapolis Police Department is not on trial, in the sense that the links to white supremacy and white nationalism that I think are embedded deeply within MPD, those things are not on trial. The system is working as designed. And obviously that's problematic in a number of different ways. I think one of the interesting conversations that's come out of the murder of George Floyd and this trial process is that we have a growing number of individuals who are just ordinary community members who are starting to catch on to that idea. They're starting to realize that the system as designed is insufficient, that it doesn't really play into notions of community justice. It doesn't allow for the participation of community members who have actually been victimized, whether that was by an individual law enforcement officer, whether that was their victims of the historic trauma of being raised African-American in this city or in this country. I think a growing number of people are starting to realize that there are inherent flaws. And that's part of what you saw last summer during the uprising, is you saw people out in the streets, you saw people upset and frustrated and angry and voicing their ire at the system, right? There was a lot of anger directed at Derek Chauvin, but a lot of what happened last summer with the uprising was directed at the system. And that's why you heard calls to abolish the police. That's why you heard calls to defund the police. That's why you heard calls for greater systemic change and not just the prosecution of Derek Chauvin.
But just in the last few minutes, Andrew, you were describing what happened in front of the courthouse with the family, and I guess with the family's attorney, Benjamin Crump, that it was a dignified ceremony. So is that to say that the anger and outrage after George Floyd's murder was seen by so many people on television, and it prompted massive demonstrations across the country and around the world? It's a different mood now, I take it, outside that courthouse. Just describe what the mood is in the city now.
Oh, I wouldn't even say it's a different mood, to be perfectly honest with you. I think what happened this morning was designed for an audience to be captivated by it, right? I think when you talk to community members out here, whether you're talking to them on the street, whether you are in online forums, whether you're talking to someone in the supermarket, there is still a significant amount of anger and frustration that is directed not just at Derek Chauvin, but then you have to remember we had the experience last summer of really pushing for and advocating and having that conversation about defunding the police and abolishing the police. And that energy was taken, and I'm not going to say it was squandered, but it was certainly efficiently redirected by our city council and by the City Charter Commission, which found ways to get around the advocacy. And I think what you're seeing here is a maturation of the activist and advocate community here, to the extent that folks are realizing that just being in the streets and just being upset is not enough. That there have to be processes that we're employing that will lead to actionable, sustainable change. And so sometimes that means working with the city council. Sometimes that means working with a charter commission and a board, right? And that there are different ways and different approaches to achieve the result that people are looking to achieve. Not just the reforms that people are looking to achieve, but some of the bigger systemic changes that we're looking to achieve. And so you're, I would bet that when we get to the verdict, when we get to closing arguments, you're going to see a large number of individuals back out in the streets. You're going to see those individuals showing and representing the same type of frustration, once again, because they know the system is non-trial. They know the system isn't going to change, irrespective of whether Derek Chauvin is found guilty or not, and that there is still work to do. And I think everyone understands that, we now have a better understanding of what that work needs to look like.
But my God, Andrew, what if he's exonerated Derek Chauvin? I mean, isn't that, we saw here in Los Angeles what happened when the cops had beat the hell out of Rodney King were exonerated.
Yeah, I don't think, I think when you're looking at the fortification of downtown Minneapolis, when you're looking at the National Guard being brought in, I think what you're seeing is the fear on behalf of the authorities that they are going to see significant mayhem and rioting if there's an acquittal. I don't think anyone thinks we're going to see that type of violence if there's a guilty verdict. And I think what everyone is preparing for is a worst-case scenario. And to be perfectly honest with you, I would love to sit here and tell you that those aren't legitimate concerns. But there is still a level of frustration out here. There is still a level of anger out here that I think would only be fed by an acquittal. Because now it was, okay, well, the process should work. We should get the result that everyone expects because we've all seen the evidence. We've all seen the video. And if even under those circumstances, we weren't even able to get a modicum of justice, then what's left but to burn it all down?
Well, Andrew Gordon, I thank you very much for joining us here today, and I hope I can stay in touch with you throughout this trial.
Oh, for sure. I'm happy to help when I can.
And again, I've been speaking with Andrew Gordon, who's the Deputy Director of Community Legal Services at the Legal Rights Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, whose work advocates for communities of color and immigrants. In 2016, he was awarded the Social Justice Award by the Minnesota chapter of the National Lawyers Guild for his work representing individuals charged with protest-related crimes following the murder of Jamar Clark. And he was also a part of the team awarded with the Law of the People Award for his work supporting community advocates following the murder of George Floyd. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Stay.